The Guardian.
The joy of ebooks is that great stories are just a click away. For our podcast listeners, we have a great offer on Luke Harding's book Mafia State, a menacing tale of life as a journalist in present-day Russia. I'll tell you more at the end of the show.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. Welcome to a special edition of the podcast. This week, it's all about the 2012 Nobel Prizes in Physiology or Medicine, Physics and Chemistry. We'll be talking about the call that every scientist dreams of getting on a rainy October morning.
Hello.
Oh, hello. I'm sorry to call so very early. May I speak to Professor David Wineland, please?
Certainly, just a minute.
To discuss the awards and analyse the achievements in detail, I'll be joined by the Guardian science correspondent, Ian Sample, and science writer Ewan Calloway from Nature magazine. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Now, there are two occasions when national pride is allowed here on Science Weekly. One is when producer Jason settles in to watch the Eurovision Song Contest. The second is, of course, when someone from our fair shores wins a Nobel Prize for their scientific endeavour. This year's prize for physiology or medicine went to two scientists, Shinya Yamanaka, based in Japan and the US, and to the British biologist Sir John Gurdon. Sir John is, by all accounts, the nicest and most modest man in British biology. He gave me some time out of his hectic schedule to talk to me from his home in Cambridge. First of all, congratulations. Thank you very much for your time. Can I just ask you to take me back to 1962, when you were doing these experiments that you won the Nobel for? What were you doing?
Yes. That was when the first, I would say, important published work, first work to be really important was published. I should explain, first of all, the question that we were asking.
Yeah.
And that is whether all cells of the body have the same genes, same sets of genes or not. And the background is that this question had been preeminent in people's minds, embryologists' minds, for at least 100 years. But there was, up to that time, there was no real test of this. So the design of the work I did was to take a specialized cell, in this case an intestinal cell, take the nucleus out of that cell and insert it into an egg, an unfertilized egg whose own genes had been removed, and ask whether the intestine nucleus coupled with a non-nucleate egg could make a complete individual. And the result was that in some cases it did. And so that seemed to show that the intestine cell nucleus had all genes needed for the whole of development, and therefore that there was the concept of the conservation of the genome, and that there is no loss of genes or inability of them to be reactivated.
So what was the prevailing idea at the time? Before you answered this question, did people think that different cells might have had different sets of genes?
Yes, they did. It was actually formally proposed in the late 1800s that as the embryo develops into different cell types and tissues, the genes that were no longer needed could be lost or at least permanently inactivated, put out of action. That was a possible thought, an idea.
Now, your work led to lots of people doing similar cloning type technologies. Famously, Ian Wilmot did the experiments that led to Dolly the Sheep in the late 90s in Scotland, which he uses a very similar technique.
It was exactly the same technique. So, in actual fact, before I was able to publish or did publish the 1962 paper, I had published a picture a couple of years before of a whole clone of adult frogs. So the method of transplanting the nucleus out of a cell into a non-nucleated egg and growing an individual was well established for frogs. And subsequently, we had this rather striking picture of a whole clone of albino frogs derived from a dark green frog, a true clone of some 30 or so animals derived by nuclear transplantation.
Now, fast forward almost 50 years, and Shinya Yamanaka was doing his work, which was to use a chemical cocktail to reprogram a mature cell into a stem cell. Tell me what you knew about his work when he was doing it. I mean, you must, your lab at Cambridge, I'm assuming, is doing similar work as well. So what kinds of technologies were they looking at the time?
It was very different. His spectacular paper appeared in 2006, I think. And what they did was to take genes as bits of DNA and transfer them by absorption into other embryo cells, into different kinds of cells. This meant overexpressing genes in their case, so the cell gets new genes that it didn't have before. In our case, there's no change in genes. You simply take the normal nucleus of a specialized cell, and the reactivation is due to the components of the egg, whereas in his experiments, by putting these special gene factors in, those factors are able to reactivate genes that were dormant in the recipient cells.
Now, would you have picked out that technology as a significant step and something that is, you know, a sort of a spiritual successor to the work you were doing so long ago?
Yes, in many ways it's a very, very valuable successor. And the reason is primarily this, that if you wanted to transfer our kind of experiments to humans, you would have to have human eggs. And these are extremely hard to get in any significant number. So our kind of work is not appropriate for humans. His work is, because you don't need eggs, you just need cells to be able to receive these overexpressed components.
How well do you know Professor Yamanaka? I mean, you must be pleased to be sharing the prize with him.
Well, I met him very soon after his early experiments were announced, and I've seen him on several occasions since, including visiting his laboratory.
Now, tell me what happens next in terms of the technologies that you did and he has carried out since. Will we see treatments? Is it a more basic biological bit of research? And where do you see this technology?
There are really two directions to go in which to go forward. One is to use exactly his technique to take cells from diseased patients suffering from various diseases, and try to grow cells that represent that disease in the laboratory, in culture. If that is successful, and it may well be soon, you can use drugs to test which kind of drugs could help alleviate that disease. So it's a way of finding out what drugs would be really useful for alleviating disease without having to inject the drugs into a human being, which you really couldn't do. So that's the first route of great value. The subsequent one, which will occur later, I think, is to go for cell replacement. What that means is that if you have some part of the body that isn't working very well or at all, you try to derive from something like skin new embryo cells, grow those cells into the failing part, and then put those replacement cells back into a patient to give them back the function of the failing part, but importantly, it could be done with the patient's own genetically own kinds of cells, thereby avoiding immunosuppression.
Now, this kind of regenerative medicine has been on the horizon for a long time. People have talked about it as a result of stem cell work for some time. Do you think that it's a genuine possibility that we'll be able to do that, actually grow organs or tissues for replacement? And if so, what are the non-scientific sort of hurdles along the way?
Well, first of all, I would say it is a real possibility as long as you don't try to replace a whole organ. It's inconceivable at the moment to replace a whole brain or a complete heart because they're complex organs with many different kinds of cells in them. If, however, you want to replace one particular kind of cell, and I have in mind photoreceptors of the eye, that is entirely realistic. And I guess that the correction of failing vision may be the first instance in which this cell replacement technology is likely to take place. Now, you also said, I think, what are the constraints? Was that right?
That's right. Well, outside the technology, do you think there are societal constraints to any of this?
I think the technology is essentially there. They can replace the retinal pigmented epithelium of the eye on which the photoreceptors thrive. They need that to function properly. That's technically possible, and in fact it's been done in animals. And the replacement cells, of which not a large number are needed, some 10 to 50,000 will do, they will then grow back in the eye into the position in which the failing cells were. So this seems to be, to me, a real possibility. It's not our work, a real possibility for a therapeutic value of this kind of cell replacement.
Do you think that the regulators are set up for this? You mentioned just after the awards were made on Monday that you perhaps thought that some of the American regulators, perhaps the British ones too, are sort of slowing down this technology getting into hospitals.
Yes, I think that's a worry. Once anything is given to humans, these regulators really dig in and say, can you prove beyond all conceivable doubt that there's nothing harmful that could go in as well? And I see that as a danger, that they may obstruct progression in this area, greatly to many people's disappointment. But at the moment, it ought really to be likely it should be possible, certainly possible to do this, and likely it might survive these regulators.
Ian, you met Sir John hours after he was awarded here the Nobel Prize. What kind of chap is he?
He's a spectacular guy. He's kind of everything you would want in an ambassador, or even, forget all that ambassador for science stuff. He's just a really nice guy and really bright and just modest and interesting. I mean, it was terrible. I came away just thinking, what an amazing person. I'd never met him before, sadly.
And also, he has a very fine mop of hair.
I wasn't going to mention the hair. I mean, he looks like Michael Heseltine.
You and Sir John Gurdon sort of started the field of cloning biology, essentially, in the 60s. And Shinya Yamanaka actually turned it into something that could be used in humans. So tell us a bit about what he did and then why it's so important.
Yeah, Sir John Gurdon, he was the first one to show that through cloning a frog, that all the information to create a little tadpole was contained in the nucleus of an adult cell, of a mature adult frog cell. So he did that by transplanting a nucleus from an adult frog to an egg and had that develop into a whole frog. What Shinya Yamanaka did was he transformed an adult cell itself into an embryonic stem cell, which is the kind of cell that gives rise to all the tissues in an organism, first in mice and then later, a year later, in humans. So it's really a great follow-up, I think, from Sir John Gurdon's work.
And he did that by simply inserting four genes, which sounds ridiculously simple. I mean, obviously not to someone who doesn't do this all the time, but it doesn't sound too complicated.
No, it was an amazing experiment. And, you know, you talk with a lot of biologists about great experiments, and this one from Shinya Yamanaka and his former student is listed as one. What they did was they identified these proteins that are in embryonic stem cells, these cells that give rise to every tissue, and they identified the proteins that they thought maintained them in their embryonic state, and they put them all into an adult cell, all 24 of them, and then started taking them away until they hit on four proteins that maintain the embryonic stem cells. And now they're called the Yamanaka factors.
And so in a sense, you can then use this technology to turn a skin cell or any other cell of a person into a stem cell and then use that to eventually do the things that stem cell biology once promised but was restricted from doing because of the fact that you needed a human egg, essentially, or a human embryo to actually extract stem cells in the first place. So treatments anytime soon? I mean, when will we start seeing these sorts of things coming along, that all this stuff that we've been promised from stem cell research from a long time?
Well, I think we're right now, the first clinical trials for embryonic stem cells are going on right now in Britain and in the US. They're treating a rare form of blindness with embryonic stem cells. And I know of some researchers in Japan, not Yamanaka, but they're interested in treating a similar disease, similar form of blindness, with these induced pluripotent stem cells, these reprogrammed stem cells. And those have the advantage of being, you can use them from a person's own skin cells, and so you don't have this immune reaction that you might get with embryonic stem cells from another person.
Ian, Sir John, when he was in his press conference on Monday, talked about problems that these treatments that Ewan's talking about might have in, you know, actually getting to the clinic, because these are brand new things, and rightly speaking, regulators sort of have are cautious about them, but perhaps too cautious in the US. The Federal Drugs Administration is perhaps halting some of this progress, he was saying.
Yeah, I mean, he was saying that there are an awful lot of elements to this work. I mean, you've got to think, how are you going to do the, how are you going to isolate the skin cells? How are you going to do the transformation to an embryonic-like state? How are you then going to transform that into the kind of tissue you might want to put back into a person, and all the screening that you have to do along the way to check for safety? There are so many steps which need to go over, pass certain tests for the FDA to approve all these things, that he said the cost of doing this procedure at the moment is not scientifically, it's not prohibited by the science, it's prohibited by these sort of regulatory hurdles. And he was saying that he thought that it should come to a point where, he said, people of his age and older, and he's like 79, I believe, should be maybe given a bit of a break on this, and that the rule should be a bit relaxed, and doctors should be able to say to them, look, there's a chance that a virus may have got into these cells. It might show up once we've put these into you, but, you know, on the other hand, these cells might help you. And he's very much up for patients having more control over this, and he specifically said he didn't want doctors, ethicists, or priests getting in the way.
Okay, Ewan, you know more about the American situation. I mean, are there specific regulatory hurdles that stem cells biologists are worried about there?
Oh, yeah, there are tons of hurdles. I mean, safety being the biggest one. To make these induced pluripotent stem cells, one of the original factors is a gene that's linked to cancer. So you've got to deal with that right there, that some of these therapies could be, you know, could turn cancerous. That's something that can be overcome. And I think the U.S. Food and Drug Administration's perspective is that they want these trials to be done safely and responsibly, so that when and if we do get these therapies, that they work. And I think the concern is that if you have people kind of dabbling here and dabbling there, you could have one major mess up, like we saw with gene therapy a decade ago with the death of an American teenager, and that could set back the whole field a decade, even more so. We're only now seeing the first, you know, effective gene therapy treatments. So I think they're hoping that stem cells will be used responsibly.
Okay, well, let's move on to physics. This year's award went to two scientists who worked out a way to experiment on individual atoms and particles of light.
This year's Nobel Prize in Physics is about the interaction between light and matter. The Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences has decided to award the 2012 Nobel Prize in Physics to Serge Haroche at Collège de France and École Normale Supérieure, Paris, France, and David J. Vineland at National Institute of Standards and Technology and University of Colorado, Boulder, USA. And the Academy citation runs for ground.
That was the Nobel Committee making their announcement. So to get a physicist's perspective on this year's winners, I spoke to Sir Peter Knight from Imperial College London, himself a researcher in the area of quantum optics and president of the Institute of Physics. Can you just explain to me what Serge Haroche and David Wineland won the prize for?
Right, the citation, there is actually an accurate citation. What they've done is, using completely different sort of vehicles, they've been able to explore quantum behavior of quite simple quantum systems under exquisite control, where they can manipulate the kind of spooky properties that we've come to discuss at physics dinner parties, coherence, entanglement, Schrödinger cats, all these kinds of things. They can do this stuff in the lab by manipulating the atomic properties and the way they interact with light. The vehicles they use are quite different, but the outcomes shed very complementary light on our fundamental understanding. So that it's simultaneously exploring the quantum world in its most intricate, sophisticated way, these incredibly fragile things that happen in the quantum world, but it has technological implications which are kind of surprising given it's quite exotic physics, implications for atomic clocks and time standards on one hand, and the potential to make logic circuits that obey the laws of quantum mechanics that open up the gateway in the very long term towards a quantum computer.
Okay, so you were talking about examining quantum elements, essentially. So fundamental particles like photons and other things are very difficult to isolate from their environment. And if you do isolate them, you destroy some of these weird things you mentioned. So these guys seem to find a way of sort of preserving some of that quantum weirdness.
Now, exactly.
Why would you want to do it, first of all?
Yeah. Is it why would you want to do
it?
Yeah. Yeah, because what you want to be able to do is to manipulate these funny coherence things, and as soon as you lose a bit of information, you know, somehow there was something else there that you didn't notice, and you lose a bit of information to that, all the really nice tricky things that you can exploit just go away, and you can lose a bit of information to a piece of system that you thought, well, maybe it didn't matter. It's the outside world, and when you look at nature in the round, the sort of nature that we're used to living in, it's very complicated. There's lots and lots and lots of bits of atoms and things, and it's very easy to lose that information in the sort of scramble of life that we live in at room temperatures. So what they do is to actually isolate these things so that they can unpeel the fundamental quantum behavior without the sort of muddle that the thermal life that we live in at ordinary temperatures destroys.
So we'll get on to some of the potential applications in a sec.
Yeah, okay.
Can you, in a couple of sentences, just say what specifically the experiments that they did were, how they tracked these quantum bits?
So they're very different experiments. In NIST in Colorado is Wineland's lab. And what Dave Wineland's been doing for some time is to manipulate the quantum states of trapped ions. Take an atom, ionize it, and you can hold it in space with electromagnetic fields. Just with a magnet and electrodes, you can isolate it in space in a vacuum system, and then you can manipulate that state. You can excite it with lasers, and you can cool it down. One of the most interesting things about this Nobel Prize is that each of the Nobel Prize winners had a PhD supervisor who was also a Nobel Prize winner, which is kind of interesting piece of science sociology. Dave Wineland worked with Hans Demelt, who's one of the pioneers of laser cooling of ions and of trapping of ions. And Dave has continued this and is, you know, absolutely the world leader in being able to manipulate these very cold ions in a vacuum system. So you can isolate one ion, two ions, three ions, a string of ions in a structure where they're hanging in space, trapped and isolated by electrodes and magnets. And then you can shine light on them from a laser and change the internal state of them. And that's what Dave has been doing in the most fantastic way. So he can manipulate the states of the ion. Each ion can talk to each other because they repel each other. They're charged, so they can talk to each other. And the vibrational motion of these things just vibrate a little bit in space. They're so cold that even that vibrational motion obeys the laws of quantum mechanics. So what he's able to do by the right sort of laser excitation is to manipulate all these things, change the number of excitations in the vibration, get one ion to talk to another. So he's built up a sort of gallery of things that you can do with this, making incredibly non-classical states, things that don't normally get observed in nature, but which have the most remarkable properties. They're coherent. What they're basically doing with some of the bigger chains of ions is building sort of miniature versions of what we call Schrodinger cats. You know, really freaky combinations of ions in one state and the same ions in another state, which doesn't really normally happen.
So this is the famous Schrodinger's cat that can be alive or dead, exactly, depending on whether
so
you open the
box. Rather than alive and dead, you have ions in one state or in the other state, but all of them in one state and all of them in the other. And that's a highly non-classical, highly fragile state, and he can make these kinds of things, and he regularly does.
And how did Serge Haroche do the same thing differently?
Right, now what Serge did is that he works in, so remember I said that the Wineland stuff is making these vibrational motions. Okay, what Serge does is makes a very similar sort of vibration, but this time of light, of the electromagnetic radiation in the cavity. So he's able to explore the discrete nature of the light in a cavity. So it's a resonant cavity, a sort of very, very, very high-tech version of what you have in a microwave oven. And what he's able to do is to tickle that field with probes which are microscopic in themselves. The probe is just an atom, very highly excited atom, and he flicks an atom through, and that atom is prepared in a state which is a very peculiar state. It's called a Rydberg state, very highly excited, and it has the ability to act as a very large atomic antenna. And that antenna can just excite in a different way or sense what's in that cavity field. It can excite the field or can sense what's in it. So at the same time, you've got the ability to change the field with the atom, or to throw an atom through it, and it acts as a sensor, a quantum sensor, to say what's there. So he's done very similar things. He's made Schrodinger cat states, this time not of vibration and motion of ions, but the vibrations of the light that's in the cavity. So they're very complementary things in terms of the way that theoreticians like me understand these things, but the vehicle which they're exploring is very different. Trapped ions in one place, light in a cavity with atoms being flicked through in the other. And both of these explore the idea that you can entangle states, so you get these funny quantum correlations, the sort of thing that John Bell investigated in the 1960s, showing that the quantum world is very much weirder than the classical world.
Ian, this is one of those prizes that's awarded to something that's quite difficult to understand. I mean, Sir Peter's done an amazing job in explaining what it is they did. They trapped these ions or photons and things. And it can be quite hard to understand to everyone else why this is so important. But what are some of the reactions you've heard to the prize?
What I really liked about this after talking to physicists about what they made of the award was just this sense of, we move around in this very classical physics world where we sort of, things are solid, we throw things around, we kick balls around, things like this. This very sort of Newtonian way about our world. But at the same time, we know there's this quantum world where weird stuff happens on a small scale. And what these guys did was they're really looking at what goes on at that interface between this quantum world and the classical world. And so they are looking at single atoms, at single photons and how they behave. And you get to see in an experiment in a lab what is, you see these quantum effects at work. And that in itself, I think, is really fascinating, because from that you start to learn, okay, how is this quantum stuff really manifesting itself? And you can understand that far more. Now, what is the point of all of this? Where does it lead? Well, a lot is said about quantum computers and how we're going to have these computers where, instead of having just bits which are one or zero, they can be one and zero at the same time, and you can therefore do these other problems. But some of the physicists I was speaking to were saying, well, yeah, we can do, you know, that's on the horizon. It's something that we hope to do. But really what's interesting is that what we're going to learn along the way to making those computers. And another thing still was this whole idea about you can use this kind of work to produce the most accurate clocks in the world, these incredibly, phenomenally accurate clocks. And with these kinds of things, you can start doing lab experiments that you wouldn't have dreamt of a few decades ago, such as you may be able to use clocks in a lab to test whether test general relativity, Einstein's relativity, or you could use it to test whether certain constants in nature are actually constant. So just real physical numbers we know about the world, you can actually say, are they the same in this moment in time and that moment in time, this part of the lab and that part of the lab, because you are getting to do such exquisitely precise measurements. And I think it's one of those areas where it's just going to lead into just really phenomenal physics in the future.
Ewan, you're a fan of physics, I know.
Yeah.
You must have questions about this.
Well, so I have a question. Why didn't the Higgs win?
Well, the Higgs didn't win. The Higgs, as in the Hof being Peter Higgs. Now, I suppose there were some people who thought the Higgs boson might get the Nobel Prize in Physics this year because of CERN's announcement in July that they'd essentially found it. Now, the people I spoke to, and among them were former committee secretaries from the Nobel Committee, were saying that the rule book says that the publication that triggers the award has to be in print at least a year before the award is given. So that pretty much rules it out. I mean, at the moment, there are two papers published which talk about a five sigma result, the higher than five sigma result, a strong result basically for a particle that looks like the Higgs. But there's not actually a paper that says we found the Higgs. And if there is, it was, you know, if you're kind, it still came out this year. So you need extra time. I think it's a strong contender for next year.
You put money on that?
I will put money on it, yeah. The problem is there's also a huge tangle to work out as to who that prize goes to. There are about five theorists who can sensibly lay claim to the prize. CERN expects, I don't know about expects, but deserve a mention as well. So the Nobel Committee has a hell of a time working out who to even give that prize for.
Ian, I am willing to bet you £10 right here, right now, on the Guardian Science podcast that the Higgs will not win the Physics Nobel Prize.
Have you
next
got another
year.
One will in accept? Contention? Have you got another idea in contention? Is that what it is? Do you know, do you have an inside track on something?
No, I have no inside track, but I know this is good money.
Ian?
I will accept, or I'll go to 20 if you want.
This escalation is
I work
worrying.
In nature, not the Guardian.
There is actually something to be said about people who miss out on these awards. I mean, we didn't talk about this for the Medicine or Physiology Prize, but there was a couple of people, perhaps who could have been on that list, Ewan, who did similar work, to Yamanaka especially.
Yeah, we had a really good chat about this on the Twitter. I have two scientists in mind, Sir Ian Wilmot, the stem cell biologist in Edinburgh, who of course famously created Dolly about 15 years ago. And what he really did was he took Sir John Gurdon's work, which was done in frogs, and showed that yes, you can do it in mammals, and that was revolutionary. No one questions that. And there's another scientist, James Thompson from the University of Wisconsin, who. He's done a couple of really key things. He was the first person to isolate human embryonic stem cells, which are these cells that give rise to every type in the body. And then he followed on Yamanaka's work in mice by creating these induced stem cells in humans right about at the same time. But I think the committee, in selecting just Sir John Gurdon and just Shinya Yamanaka, was really sending a message that these two discoveries, cloning and reprogramming, were breakthroughs. They were game changers. And the other work, while important, was follow-up.
Well, just imagine, cloning a mammal for the first time is just follow-up work. That's incredible. Incredible. Well, let's move on to the chemistry prize now. Last but not least, it's an unpredictable category given the wide range of subjects involved.
This year's prize deals with cells and sensibility. The Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences has decided to award the 2012 Nobel Prize in Chemistry to Professor Robert J. Lefkowitz at Howard Hughes Medical Institute and Duke University Medical Center, Durham, North Carolina, USA, and Professor Brian K. Kobilka at Stanford University School of Medicine, Stanford, California, USA.
This year's award went to two scientists working on a protein that sits in the membranes of all our cells, the G-protein coupled receptor. To set the chemistry award into some context, I spoke to David Phillips, past president of the Royal Society of Chemistry. I started out by asking him to describe what a G-protein coupled receptor was.
Well, this is a protein which exists in all animal advanced cells, I mean animal cells, particularly human cells. And it extends, it has a piece which extends into the surrounding area of the cell, the environment of the cell. And then there are kind of seven loops that go through the membrane itself. And then there's a piece which goes inside the cell. And these things are designed to sense particular materials in the cell, which will then invoke a response in the cell and ultimately in the animal, for example. So they are used really very, very widely in the human body. Something like, the fact that you can see vision is due to the rhodopsin-type receptors, which obviously are in the retina, in the eye. There are other receptors of this same type which sense smell and taste. Others which sense very important ones. One of the first ones to be looked at was those which sense adrenaline. And of course, you produce, when adrenaline is present, you get a reaction which leads to an increased heart rate and blood pressure, which is, you know, the fight or flight kind of syndrome that we talk about in biology.
And so how many of them are there in the human body?
There are, well, who knows? I mean, there are 350, I think, of known function, whether we know what they do. And there are 150 which have been discovered and characterized, but we don't know what they do. And so there could be many, many more. There are effectively in the body 1,000 genes which code for these particular types of protein-coupled receptors. And so we know that they're very, very important in the way the cell functions.
And so tell me what the two Nobel Prize winners did. So Robert Lefkowitz and Brian Kobilka, what were their roles in discovering these things?
Kobilka was a research student with Lefkowitz in the 60s, I think. And so until 1968, cell biologists had perhaps, they didn't know how cells responded to their environment. They suspected that there might be specific receptors on a cell which were specific for particular materials in their environment, but nobody knew. I mean, nobody had proved that. Nobody had identified any of these, and certainly the structure of them was beyond any speculation. So what Lefkowitz did was to radioactively label some potential, it was an adrenaline type material that he did, and then showed that this bound specifically to something on the cell. And he was able to isolate what it was that the adrenaline was binding to. And that was really the first demonstration, I think, that these receptors existed. And then subsequent to that, a long time subsequent to that, they actually were able to work out the molecular structure of these. And I think the prize for chemistry has gone because it is in the molecular structure which allows you to understand the function and also to perhaps then model new drugs.
Ewan, we're still on biological terms here. What is the G-protein coupled receptor from your student days? Tell me what it is.
It was the bane of my biochemistry class. These are hugely important receptors that are basically sandwiched within cell membranes, and they communicate things from the outside of the cell into the inside. That's what they...
See, that's what we knew. Something must be doing that. Before these guys did this work in the 60s, we knew that something outside the cell would signal to something inside the cell, and these receptors, there was some thing that mediated that, and they initially found that the receptor was the way in, and then it was Kobilka who actually crystallized and worked out the structure of these things in 2007. How significant are they? I mean, we heard David talking about how they're responsible for a lot of drug interactions. There's hundreds of types in the human body. Could give us a scale of that?
Yeah, so this is a whole family of receptors. And I think somebody estimated that anywhere between one-third and one-half of all drugs that are approved act on these receptors, either by blocking them or manipulating them in some way. A great example is beta blockers that are used for heart conditions. Those target G protein coupled receptors. In fact, one of the ones that the two laureates were studying. And the significance of their work, particularly Kabilka's work determining what you call the crystal structure of it, was now we know exactly what it looks like at molecular detail, so we could make better drugs that block it or manipulate these receptors that have fewer side effects. That's why this is important.
Okay, and Ian, these two are, by any measure, biologists, maybe even doctors. They're winning a chemistry prize, though, and it's got some chemists a bit pissed off already. Well, what do you think?
Well, these two guys, as we were saying earlier, they may be the first two medical doctors to get the Nobel Prize in chemistry. They certainly both are MDs. Now, does that reflect a lack of sort of interesting stuff going on in more, you know, what we might think of as more traditional chemistry? Or is this just saying that biology is getting to the point where to do the certain kinds of biology they want to do, they're getting down to the physical scales where essentially you're doing chemistry? And I think that's probably the answer, is that this is microscopic biology. You know, you're getting down to the genetic level, you're getting down to the molecule level, because you need to know how molecules latch onto other things. And this is very much chemistry at that level.
To understand this, to understand genetics, I mean, molecular biology, we talk about this all the time, is essentially chemistry, isn't it, Ewan?
It is. I mean, I would just echo what Ian said and what the bloggist and medicinal chemist Derek Lowe was saying, that biology has essentially turned into chemistry, and chemistry has turned into biology. And the question is, how long before biologists start winning the physics prize?
Well, we had Jim Al-Khalili on the other day talking about quantum biology, so we'll give it a few years. There's going to be some crossover there. Now, before we wind up, here's a cautionary tale for anyone who thinks they should do whatever their school teachers tell them. You might think that every scientist, and especially those who become Nobel laureates, might have been spurred on by their teachers in their youth. A healthy interest in science begins with a good teacher, after all. Not so for Sir John Gurdon.
Well, what happened was, when I was at school, age 15, I was given my first term of science. No science until 15. Then we did one term of it. And this was the biology master, who was quite explicit in his criticism. He said he had heard some talk of Gurdon being interested in being a scientist, but this was completely ridiculous, and it would be a total waste of time, both for him and for teachers, if he were to do science. And I ended up bottom of the bottom form of the whole of that year at school. So that meant that my science was immediately discontinued, and the school master in charge of my education arranged for me to, from that point onwards at school, to study Greek literature and Latin.
Which I'm sure is very interesting, but how did you get from there to studying science at university?
Yes, that was a problem, because having left school with no scientific qualification whatsoever, my kind parents, perhaps mother in particular, could see that actually what I was really interested in was science and biology and not primarily classics. So with a large amount of effort, she got me introduced to people in positions of influence. And also, my parents gave me two extra years beyond private education to transfer into science and to qualify myself to start a degree in zoology at Oxford. So that was an extra 2 years of work. And it was arranged that if I could survive those 2 years, I would be allowed to study science.
Well, clearly 2 years well spent. Now, there's going to be people listening to this this program who probably don't think they're very good at science, or have been told they're not very good at science at school, and maybe want to continue in some way. What would be your message to those young people who perhaps feel that this isn't a subject for them?
Well, I would hope they would first say, does this subject, what they've heard of it, really interest them enough to work hard and really dedicate themselves to studying the relevant kind of science. And I had to work extremely hard at that time in my life to make up the lost ground. But of course, it worked out. I was able to do that, and the career can be extremely rewarding if you can manage. But if first things don't go right, it's a great pity to give up, because one can recover these problems, and one can have poor teaching or something else can happen. So I would take the view that if they feel interested in science, it would be a terrible pity to give it up just because some school person might say you'd be better at something else.
So, John, that's all I had to ask. Thank you very, very much for your time. And I hope you have a great afternoon as well, with all the other interviews I'm sure you've got lined up.
Okay, well, thank you for talking to me.
Thank you very much. Speak soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So, science teachers, take note. Well, a big congratulations to this year's Nobel laureates. To read about the winners, you can go to lots of places. I recommend you start at guardian.co.uk/science. Move on to nobelprize.org. Thanks also to podcast laureates Ian Sample and Ewan Calloway. You can read more from Ewan at nature.com/news. Thanks very much, guys.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
But from me, Alok Jha, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
For a limited period only, we have an exclusive ebook offer for Guardian podcast listeners. Guardian columnist Luke Harding's Mafia State is a dark and ominous insight into the life of a journalist in present-day Russia. We're offering 30% off the list price of $4.99. All you have to do is go to the ebook store www.kobo.com, that's KOBO.com, and at checkout put in the discount code Mafia State for your Guardian podcast offer.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.